This is an interview with Alfred T. Goodwin, May 10th, 1985, Tape 2, Side 2.
Well, when you went on to high school at Crook County High School in Prineville, were there some intellectual interests that were emerging in that period?
Well, yeah, I think the main intellectual interest, I had a very good English teacher by the name of Gertrude Whitus, mm-hmm. and Miss Whitus encouraged me to write. So I would take stuff down and offer it to the local paper, and they'd print it once in a while. Little feature stories. Mm-hmm. And then I was a co-editor with another student of the school paper, which was a little mimeograph sheet. And the working on the school paper kind of gave me an idea about journalism. And then I went to the University of Oregon School of Journalism had a what they call an annual high school press conference, where they bring in the editors of all the high school newspapers and put them up over a weekend at the University of Oregon, and they'd have a tour of the journalism school and the mm-hmm. press and Oregon Daily Emerald, which is the daily paper. And as a high school kid, I was very much impressed with that, and I decided I'd go to the University of Oregon and major in journalism, and I did. So my last year of high school, I was kind of thinking about journalism as a possible career. Although I wasn't certain that I would go to the university, but that was what I kind of wanted to do. And of course, the war hadn't started yet. I graduated from high school in the summer of 1940. The summer before that and that summer, both I worked on this ranch up in the upper country, up between where Crook and Grant and Harney counties all come together, between Prineville and Burns, mm-hmm. at about the 5,000 foot level in the high country up there, Suplee. And I had become a fairly proficient cowboy by this time. I mean, I could do ride bucking horses and rope calves and do ranch work, and was competent as a ranch hand, and of course I enjoyed that very much. So I could hardly wait for school to be out in the summer so I could get back on my horse and go up to Suplee and work on the ranch all summer. Oh, yeah. And hunt deer and do all the things that kind of the fantasy life of a city kid who gets a chance to get out and live on a really big cattle ranch.
Were you earning money that paid for your college education at that
time? Well, yeah, because a dollar went quite a ways. I came out of, at the end of the summer, I might have a couple of $100 cash, but that would pay almost a whole year's tuition at the University of Oregon.
Yeah. What other activities were you involved in high school? Did you get involved in sports at all?
No, we lived in town, but I had a job every night after school. I would go out to there was a woman who had a boarding house where she fed single men, or loggers mostly, because mm-hmm. there was a little small logging industry around Prineville. And Mother Dobbs, they call her, Mrs. Dobbs' boarding house, had its own cows and chickens. And so I did the same kind of farm work for Mother Dobbs that I had done when we lived on our little stump farm up near Chehalis.
Right.
So, and I got paid for that. And Mrs. Dobbs let me use her car, which was a terrific deal for a 16-year-old kid. You know, they were getting a new Chevrolet and they were driving downtown to pick up the sack of spuds or something. Uh-huh. So I got to use the car and I got to, but I would go after school, I'd go there and do my chores at the boarding house, and then before school in the morning also. So I couldn't go out for basketball or football because they were, you know, conflicted with the schedule. Uh-huh. And partly as a result of that agricultural background, I never did become a proficient with using sports equipment.
Uh-huh.
But one thing Dad was good about, he helped me get those early jobs. He would take me out to a ranch and say, he'd introduce me to the rancher and he'd say, this kid wants to work for you. And you know, the rancher looked me over. And I got all my first two or three ranch jobs that way, from Dad just pushing me into it.
Uh-huh.
So he really helped me that way. And then once I got, so I felt good about myself as a cowhand, I really, for the first time, I really felt like there was something I was really good at that I could do. And I think that was when my own self-esteem started to blossom, was when I was working on those ranches. And
it
was, and they treated me, the rancher would treat me like a, you know, a grown man, and I was 16, 17 year old kid.
Uh-huh.
And, I really, and that was when I really began to develop sort of self-confidence. Later, when I went in the Army and I'd run into things at boot camp that were kind of stressful, I'd think, oh, hell, this isn't so bad. Things were worse on the ranch. And I'd remember some episode, you know, on the ranch where I'd have to go a long time without them, you know, out looking for the workhorses in the spring, for instance. And I'd go out 2 or 3 days with a saddle horse and ride over 100 miles of range looking for the workhorses so I can bring them back so we can start the hay.
Right.
And some of the things that happened in the military weren't any more strenuous than that. So.
You also mentioned this period as a time when you began to be more sensitive to the relationships in your family, just noticing things more. And I wondered how your own social life was developing at that time with both males,
yeah,
and boy-girl females.
Relations, yeah. Well, I was, of course, in high school, there were always two or three girls that would, I suppose any young woman in high school or any young man would always sort of fix on one or two classmates that were more interesting than others, mm-hmm. for various reasons. And there were two or three girls in high school that I liked, liked.
Yeah.
But I didn't date much in high school. I was a year younger than everybody else in my class. And so the girls, who mature a little bit faster than boys do anyway, the 18-year-old girls weren't much interested in a 17-year-old boy, even though I was in their class in high school.
Uh-huh.
So I didn't get much of an affirmative response from the girls in the high school that I liked. And I didn't have time to try to date the younger girls in the high school because I was working after school and the kids would go hang out at the local soda fountain. I'd be working, so, and I didn't go to the basketball. I didn't play basketball, and if you weren't an athlete, you weren't anybody.
Yeah.
So, you know, I didn't have a lot of, I didn't get a lot of attention from the girls, although there were a couple of them that I liked that were nice to me and that we were good friends, and we still are, as a matter of fact. There's a couple of women over there in Prineville that I still see once in a while, and we're still friends, and the friendship is pretty much on the same basis as it was 45 years ago.
Yeah, that's interesting.
I didn't get interested in girls sexually until I was in the Army. And college was, there was a lot of dating behavior in college that was just sort of organized. I mean, they'd have these contrived events to bring freshmen together.
Uh-huh.
I mean, things like sock hops, where people take off their shoes and slide around on their stocking feet in the gym, or stuff like that. I wasn't terribly excited about all that. I go to some of those things, but I wasn't a very good dancer, partly because of having not been very socially active in high school.
Yeah.
And so I wasn't a big ladies' man in college. I started going steady with a girl that worked on the Emerald, and we ended up getting married, but it didn't last. I mean, it was my first marriage, but which I'm perfectly willing to talk about when we get to it, if you're interested.
Okay.
But anyway, that was my, so I kind of focused on that one girl, and I started dating in college, she was a rather carefully brought up young woman who didn't believe in any premarital sex, and I'd been brought up that way, so. And of course, there wasn't any kind of dependable birth control in those days, so you did have certain restrictions on your
sure.
sexual exploration. I didn't really discover much about girls until I was a soldier at basic training. I would have been a junior in college if I, you know, had.
The war hadn't interrupted.
Well, as a matter of fact, it was. I did finish the junior year, and then I went to Camp Roberts. I met a guy in alphabetically, you know, how you're arranged in boot camp. I don't know if I'm getting ahead of the story, but.
Well, we can go on with this.
But
yeah.
Reproductive behavior is part of life, and when I was essentially still a teenager, you know, I was 19 or 20 years old. In 1943, I was 20. I turned 20.
Yeah.
And I was still virtually, I guess, if one could be virtually a virgin. at age 20.
I think I know what you mean.
You know, these fumbling affairs in high school or college never really amounted to anything that one really characterized as an act of intercourse.
Yeah.
But I met this friend, and we became friends in boot camp at Camp Roberts. And his name was, well, I think I'll, to protect the guilty, I'll just not.
That's okay. Sure.
He's still around.
Sure.
Anyway, he was a professor at Berkeley, who had gotten drafted. He was about 7 or 8 years older than I was. He was a young professor in the Romance Language Department, and he had gotten drafted because he had no children and he had no basis for a deferment. And they were taking everybody, and so. About my friend the professor. he felt sorry for me. He discovered that I wasn't terribly sexually, he told me, he says, Ted, you're sexually retarded. You haven't had any experience. he said he was married.
Uh-huh.
But he says, I've got a couple of single woman friends in Berkeley that you ought to get acquainted with. And so he'd take me home with him on weekend passes from Camp Roberts, which was 100 miles south of San Francisco, during the summer of 43, and he fixed me up with a date. And one of them turned out to be a woman who was very, you know, experienced, a couple of years older than I was.
Uh-huh.
Worked in the Alameda Air Naval Base with his wife. Was interested in dating, but wasn't interested in any permanent arrangements.
Mm-hmm.
And she introduced me to the joys of reproductive behavior, and I had a wonderful summer, courtesy of the Berkeley professor.
Uh-huh.
So from then on, I decided that there was a whole lot more to it than just howdying and shaking, you know. And,
yeah. Did you have any? Qualms still stemming from your upbringing?
My Puritan upbringing?
Yeah.
Yeah, I had some little feelings of, the main feeling I had was, I think my dad and mother both had made this pretty clear, that you've got to be responsible for what you do, and you've got to think about the other person,
mm-hmm.
and don't go and leave a pregnant girl weeping on the doorstep. And I had a very strong feeling about that. And the gal in Berkeley, whose name was Louise, was fully well-versed in how to deal with that problem.
And, yeah.
And so we didn't have any problems. Mm-hmm. And she said to the professor, she said, Ed, you told me you were bringing me a man from Camp Roberts, and you brought me this callow youth. I've got to start from the beginning with this guy. Anyway.
Was she a good teacher?
She was good, yeah.
Yeah.
She was generous and kind and non-judgmental and
uh-huh.
and helped me along.
That should, that certainly helped yourself.
It was a great experience, yeah, yeah, it really was. And from then on, I was able to manage all right.
Good, good.
And then that winter, I got married to the girl that I'd been dating in college, who was the Christian Scientist who didn't believe in that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And that way, that marriage didn't work out. And we were, on paper, we were married for 5 years, but I was gone a good part of the time overseas.
And yeah.
And then when I came home, we did have the baby, who is now 38 years old. But it was obvious when I got off the boat, when I got home, that marriage was really not going to last. We parted as friends, but not, you know, it was traumatic when we had a little kid involved.
Sure.
But I still see her once in a while, and with no animosity or anything. And I've recently become quite a lot closer to the son. That was the issue of that marriage.
Uh-huh. Did she remarry too?
She remarried and lived and moved to the East Coast and took the little boy with her. And so I didn't see him from the time he was 2 until he was 16. But that, we'd get to that part of life,
yeah,
later. But
I'd like to pick up on a couple of things still going back to Prineville. I understand that you lived there for as extended a period as you had ever lived in any single place.
Yeah, that's right. That was the place I've always kind of thought of that as home.
Yeah.
Crook County.
It seems to the land and the kinds of things that you did there, your relationship with the land and with the animals and so on, seems to have really kind of made a great impression on you.
That was the
centered you as a person.
That was the significant thing, I think, in my life was becoming coming of age as a competent ranch hand, knowing all the time, though, in the back of my mind that I really wasn't going to stay there as a cowboy. I was going to go on to school. But I think if anybody had ever asked me, I would have said, well, my ambition is to go and become a successful person in one of the professions. At the early stage, I hadn't thought so much about law as I began to later, but that and then come back to Prineville and buy a ranch in Crook County. That would have been my idea of a perfect circle.
Uh-huh.
To get back to the soil.
What was it that gave you that conviction that being a cowboy wasn't going to be enough, as enjoyable as it was to you?
Oh, watching the old broken down cowboys with limping around, uh-huh, Prineville, men in their 50s who looked like they were 70, dragging a crippled leg and having a horse buck them against the corral and break their leg two or three places and not heal upright.
Yeah.
I'd see those old, and then Mary Weberg, the boss's wife on the ranch where I spent the most time, was a well-educated woman, a former school teacher who had married this rancher. And she said, Teddy, you don't want to end up like old so-and-so down there at the Polina store. And you better go down to the university as soon as school starts. And I was wanting to put it off. I kind of wanted to put it off a year, and she'd say, "Don't put it off. Mm. Go now."
Were your parents urging you?
Well, they were kind of. They had learned that you can't tell a 16 or 17-year-old kid anything, so they were working indirectly. But as I later found out with my own teenage kids, important people in my life at that time. My father and mother had pretty well played their role, and it was over, more or less. They were in kind of a passive phase. And the important people then were the rancher, Melvin Weberg, that hired me and trusted me with his high-priced equipment and his good horses. And Mary Weberg, who urged me to go on to school and counseled me against getting any of the neighbor girls pregnant, one of whom I think was quite willing to get pregnant. Her mother was kept pushing her into my vicinity one summer.
Uh-huh.
And I'd go down to the barn to harness the team in the morning, and this gal would come over and try to help me in a stall. It was, you know, about that much space between them.
Close quarters,
and she was not a particularly attractive kid, but she was eager, and I think her mother was pushing her a little bit. She probably figured that Teddy is going to be all right. You know, he might be a good provider. You ought to hang on to him. So I danced with her at the. We'd have these old range hall dances mm-hmm. in the summertime, and I knew that something could happen very easily, and I didn't want it to, so I just kind of kept my distance. But this was before my Army experience.
Oh, right, right. So.
But I was aware even then that there was a certain amount of intrigue and interest in, I was interested, but I didn't, but I also knew about the hazards, and I definitely did not want to get involved in family formation at that stage of my life. Anyway, this Mary Weberg, who's still alive, a wonderful woman, was very helpful to me in that part of my life, because she would just say a wise word now and then that would click, and I'd know that I should go ahead and get on down to Eugene and go to school. Mm-hmm.
When you say your parents were working indirectly, do you mean they were working through her?
Well, they might have passed the word to her. And there was another important man in my life, a fellow by the name of Harry Stearns, who owned a ranch near Prineville. He was down in the lower Crook County, 5 miles out of Prineville. But he was a good friend of my father, but he turned out to be a good friend to me also. When I needed a job in the wintertime, in high school, he'd hire me. He'd say, "Come on out and help me move some cattle." Or I don't know whether he did it because he thought I needed the work or just to be a nice guy. But it was a very he turned out to be a good friend, and he helped convince me that I should go on to school. And he wanted me to go to Linfield, which is where he had gone to school. But Harry Stearns was a good role model, and he was a successful rancher and a leader in the community, and he was a guy I respected, and when he paid attention to me, that made me feel good.
We've mentioned the Roosevelt administration several times, and I think indirectly we've talked about the New Deal and the efforts the Roosevelt administration took to bring the country out of depression. What evidences of what we called a few minutes ago expanded government or the New Deal programs were you aware of during the 30s and early 40s?
Well, I was aware of three things come to mind real fast. The three C's, mm-hmm. which we kind of looked down our noses. We local boys looked down our noses at the CCCs because they were from New Jersey or somewhere and didn't talk the same kind of English we did. But we noticed that they were doing good things. They were building campgrounds and trails and doing forest trails and, you know, useful things. And I was impressed that these kids from the slums of New York and New Jersey City and Cleveland and Detroit and so on were finding a good here in Oregon, uh-huh. in the Northwest. Another thing that impressed me was the WPA and those Works Progress Make Work projects, that as fast as they could, the men who were on those jobs would try to get a better job and get off of them. They were glad to have the work and the pay, but they felt the odium of being welfare recipients. I mean, they felt they were somehow branded by being WPA workers. So the first thing they would try to do is either upgrade their skills, get into another job, and get off of WPA. But WPA kept them working, and they weren't just sitting around drawing unemployment. The other thing that impressed me about that was the so-called arts projects. When I was in high school, I was introduced to live Shakespeare theater because of troops of traveling players that the WPA Theater Project would bring through the country. And I got to see a lot of live theater that a kid in ordinary, you know, lower middle class or poor circumstances would never see, but for the WPA theater project. And as a result of getting that early exposure to Shakespeare as a young teenager, I was interested in it all my life. I mean, it just enriched my life tremendously. Sure. And while I've never been a great fan of the New Deal bureaucracy and the rapid expansion of government into a lot of areas of life, I've always been grateful that the WPA kept these very talented actors and actresses from having to be, you know, working McDonald's hamburger stands or something. They could stay professional, do their work, and people all over the country got to see it. And those are the main things I remember about the New Deal. As a teenager, you don't care a lot about the deep economic figures. I mean, the rate of national growth, or the gross national product, mm-hmm. or cost of living indexes, those things. Teenagers are more worried about who's having Coca-Cola with whom, and that sort of thing.
Uh-huh. I think you explained earlier that the primary factor that led you to go to the University of Oregon was this journalism fair.
That was the main thing, and the other thing was it was affordable. Tuition was $33 a term, and if you lived in Oregon. A guy'd be a fool not to go to school at $33 a term, $110 a year for tuition, or whatever. Then you had to buy a few books, uh-huh. which were cheap. You could buy them secondhand at the bookstore. And then if you could figure out a way to live, you didn't need much money. And Dad was able to help me my junior year. My first 2 years, I was pretty much on my own, although I think I got maybe $100 or so a year from home. But my junior year, Dad, in addition to, he decided he couldn't make a living really as a minister and entirely exclusively, so he got into the real estate business, sort of on the side. But the real estate business on the side brought in enough additional income that he was producing a lot more income from real estate than he was from preaching. But he claimed to be a preacher full time, which I think he was, but he'd also go out and sell a ranch now and then. Uh-huh. And the business in 1942 started to pick up. And so when I was a junior, he called me up and said, if you want to join a fraternity, which I hadn't much thought about before. He said, if you want to join a fraternity, I'll pay for it. And I didn't know he had that much money around. And my brother Jim had come down to the university, and he wanted to join a fraternity, and he knew Dad could pay for it. So Jim was 2 years behind me uh-huh. in college, and he'd come down to the university, and so Jim went through Rush Week. And so when he was going through Rush Week, some of the people he talked to said, well, you have a brother that's already here in school, and he doesn't even belong to a fraternity. And Jim said, yeah, well, nobody ever asked him to, and he didn't think he could afford it. So they came, the guys from the ATO house came over to see me one evening. They said, why don't you come along and go through some of this rushing business with your brother? You might like it. And so I did, and I joined the ATO fraternity. So my third year in college, I was a Joe College fraternity boy with my dad paying my house bill.
What year was it then that you actually started at the University of Oregon?
In 1940,
okay.
Fall of 40.